Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, bonds, government bonds. We take a closer look at how the market works, why they matter, why they were credited with getting Trump to back down on tariffs. Also today, frustrated retirees continue to attack terrible pension top-up service. Tanya looks at whether a special annuity is the answer to paying for care, plus how to choose the right SIP for you and the great cash ISA run. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, I used to think that if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as the president or the pope or as a 400 baseball hitter. But now, I would like to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody. The famous words of James Carville, I didn't put on the accent, Bill Clinton's chief strategist. So global government bond markets are vast. They affect everyone who pays tax, saves into a pension or invests for the future. They can also be an early warning indicator for the economic outlook, both at home and abroad. So it's time we got a little more acquainted with them, don't you think? Tanya, Simon, welcome. Simon, government bonds. Why are we talking about them? Who buys them? What are they?
Government bonds are, as you just mentioned, probably the most important asset on the planet. And this is because they are considered to be the safe asset. It's where you put the money that you don't want to worry about. It's also how governments finance their spending, whether that's often short-term spending or sometimes long-term spending and investment. Because there's a lot of countries around the world, including the UK and the US and most of Europe, that don't manage to balance their books. And even if they could manage to perfectly balance their books, they might still want to borrow some money. Why would you do that? Well, maybe you can perfectly balance your books at home. But if you want to get a mortgage and buy a property, then you're going to need to borrow some money. It's secured against your home. And you pay it back over a long period of time. And that's considered to be good borrowing, a good investment, because what you're getting back from that is something in return that's going to ultimately turn out to be a good financial thing for you. And whilst we should always be very careful about extending personal finance metaphors, you know, to the world of high finance and countries, that's the sort of general vibe. So what happens if you're our fictional government? You offer to sell some bonds to investors over a certain period of time. So you might issue some bonds over 2 years, over 5 years, over 10 years. So say you decide you're going to issue some 10-year bonds to investors. You say, we'd like to raise a certain amount of money. We will pay you back over 10 years and we will pay you a certain rate of interest over those 10 years, which is known as the coupon on the bond. And at the end of it, we'll give you your money back. And so there's a yield. So say that you sell your bonds at 100. Okay, we won't specify the currency, but you know, you sell your bonds for 100 beans, right? Our currency is beans. And you tell the people who are buying your bonds, we'll pay you 5 beans a year in interest. And at the end of it, we'll give you 100 beans back. So people who want to potentially park their money somewhere where they know what return they're going to get, say, okay, we'll buy your bonds. I'm happy with my 5 beans a year and I'll lend you 100 beans and I think that you're good for it in 10 years' time. That would be a 5% yield. What can happen, however, is that you could buy or sell those bonds between the day they're issued and the day that they are redeemed. So as an investor, I could buy my government's bonds in return for my 5 beans a year and my 100 beans back at the end. But I might decide 4 years in that actually I need that money now. So I sell my bond. Now, depending on what other rates other governments are offering, other investors buying my bond, and also how much they think they're going to definitely get their money back at the end, might say, well, do you know what? Actually, I really like this five beans bond, so I'm going to pay you 105 beans for it. Or they might say, do you know what? Actually, I don't like this five beans bond because I think that you're not such a good investment. I think that to invest in you, I'm going to need six beans a year. So instead of paying you more than it's worth, more than face value, I'm going to pay you less than it's worth. So I'll pay you 90 beans for it. And this is the way that ultimately the bond market works, is if you were to buy a bond at the start and hold it to the end, and the government that has issued the bond does not go bust, then you will get your money back and you get your coupon every year. But actually, a huge amount of the government bond market involves people buying and selling bonds that already exist and deciding whether they're going to pay over the odds for them or under the odds for them. So to take two scenarios, one is when interest rates were on the floor and they were really, really low. Investors really couldn't get much return on their cash, and they were actually really, really worried about just keeping that money safe. So they were willing to accept very low interest rates on bonds. So governments could get away with issuing new bonds with very, very low interest rates. And that meant that the old bonds that were still in existence from before interest rates came down that much were in very high demand. So people were willing to pay more than face value for those bonds, because to buy something that had a 5% yield on it, well, you were willing to pay way over the odds for it because the alternative was interest rates at 0.5%. And you get that the other way around as well. Now you've got those bonds that were issued during that period, but now interest rates are much higher. So when, you know, government interest rates are at 4.5%, who wants to buy a bond that only pays 2%? Well, why would you do that? You can just park your money in the bank and pick up your 4.5%. And big financial institutions and other countries have ways of the equivalent of parking your money in the bank to do that. So those bonds that are issued with those very low rates are not in demand. And the bond rates are seen as a measure of financial stress. The safest bonds in the world are considered to be US government bonds, treasuries. UK government bonds are also considered to be very safe, and German bunds. So those are like pretty much the top three. And it's the treasuries that are the main one. And everybody likes to hold treasuries because they like to hold dollars. It's the world's major currency. It means that the US can get away with living considerably beyond its means because it can just keep issuing debt to borrow money. But what happens is at times when things don't look so good, as with the tariffs, all of a sudden bond yields might spike because everybody's worried. But actually what should happen is they should come down because everybody's worried, so they rush to safety. So they should be buying bonds. And what actually happened was they appear to be selling bonds and the bond yields went up, because when prices go down on bonds, yields go up. They move in opposite directions to each other. I hope that explained it.
That was lovely, Simon. A very good explanation. Before we sort of talk about the now, what's happening at the moment with bonds, government bonds, sort of, and the economy more generally, can be traced back a lot further. So let's go back to the financial crisis. Why not? That's a nice time, isn't it? And say what's happened to government bonds since that time.
Yes. So the problem we are in is that we are still in an era of going through the financial looking glass. The financial crisis was a seismic event in terms of the global financial system. We had the credit crunch. The credit crunch effectively involved a massive credit boom that all of a sudden imploded, and then people didn't want to lend people money. Banks didn't want to lend businesses money. Banks didn't want to lend individuals money. Banks didn't want to lend banks money because they were worried that other banks wouldn't pay it back. In fact, they were worried that other banks would go bust. And central banks, so the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve in the US, the ECB in Europe, had to step in to rescue the financial system. And they did that in a number of different ways. Firstly, they cut interest rates by as much as they possibly could. They took them down from around about kind of 5% levels to 0.5% levels. And in some cases, they went negative. Negative interest rate means that instead of being paid some money when you park your cash at the central bank, you actually end up paying the bank to hold on to your money. they also did something called quantitative easing. And quantitative easing effectively involved pumping money into the financial system. And they did this by basically buying up assets in the financial system, and then they were pushing assets into the financial system. And what this did was it dramatically lowered government bond yields. So it brought bond yields right down to the floor. And it meant that interest rates were very low. The reason why you want interest rates to be low to stimulate an economy is that you are lowering the cost of borrowing. And by lowering the cost of borrowing, in theory, you start to raise the demand for it. But at times of severe financial stress, people don't necessarily want to borrow money, however cheap it is. And the people who are going to lend them money aren't so keen on it. So the central banks did everything they possibly could to do this. We then spent many years with interest rates at rock bottom and sort of gradually tried to claw our way back from that. What then happened was COVID and the lockdowns around the world, which was another seismic financial event. And like people trying to walk up an icy slope, we ended up slipping back, cutting interest rates right down to the bone. In fact, in some cases, lower than they were post-financial crisis, and indulging in yet more rounds of quantitative easing. The central banks are now trying to unwind some of that quantitative easing. They also raised interest rates back up to what were previously considered normal levels, but they did that incredibly quickly due to the inflation spike. And this has created a scenario where there's quite a febrile atmosphere within the financial system. You look at it, everything on the surface looks fine, but actually, if you go below the surface and do a bit of digging, it doesn't take much to really rattle people. And Donald Trump has rattled investors with his tariffs because investors were convinced that he would only go to a certain point and then he would stop. And on a number of occasions, it looked like he was just going to push right on through and smash the whole system to pieces, because that was what he wanted to do, because he has this obsession with tariffs and the sort of slightly random nature of the tariffs and so on. And then there was this expected rush to safety, as I mentioned earlier, where what should have happened is as people sold shares, they rushed into safe assets like government bonds and into US government bonds. But what happened was the stock market was tumbling at the same time as the bond market was being hit. And that's an unusual situation. And that was what was credited with getting him to introduce his 90-day pause and row back slightly.
Simon, I spoke there at the start about that famous quote from James Carville about the bond market intimidating everyone. And I heard, I believe it was the former Bank of England economist, Andy Haldane, talking about how governments are slightly fearful, too fearful potentially, of the bond market. I also listened to a podcast saying, is Trump having a Liz Truss moment? So put that all together and just explain to the lay person why this is so powerful and intimidating for governments.
Because governments owe huge amounts of money, they've issued very, very large amounts of debt. And the cost of servicing that debt, if interest rates, yields on bonds go up, if investors demand more money to lend money to governments, if they say, I want a higher return, because I'm actually a bit concerned that, you know, not necessarily that they're not going to get paid back. Nobody thinks the US isn't going to pay them back, but they're worried about what they're going to get paid back. Because what you have to bear in mind is inflation. Going back to our 100 beans example, if I do a 100 beans bond over 10 years and someone invests in that, they get their 5 beans a year, they get 100 beans back at the end. If inflation is zero, then the 100 beans back at the end is worth the 100 beans that they've lent to me. But if inflation over that period is 10%, then the 100 beans that they've lent to me isn't worth 100 beans in 10 years' time. It's worth 100 beans minus 10%. It's only worth 90 beans. If inflation expectations suddenly change, and instead of thinking that inflation is going to be 10% over the next 10 years, people think something's happened that's going to mean it's 20%. For example, you've introduced tariffs on a load of stuff coming into your country. Well, you think, hang on a minute, those 100 beans in 10 years' time aren't now going to be worth what I thought they were. So they're going to be worth less. So actually, in order to compensate me for the fact that my 100 beans in 10 years' time are going to be worth considerably less than I thought they were going to be, you're going to have to pay me a bigger interest rate every year over the next 10 years for me to be willing to lend you that money. And that's what's going on here. That's what the concern is. And that's why rising bond yields pushes up the cost of servicing debt. So this has happened to us in the UK. It's happened to us twice, actually, in recent times. Rachel Reeves, in her budget in autumn, left herself a certain amount of headroom, it's termed. It's basically to hit her fiscal targets. That was wiped out by the time we got to the spring statement due to higher government bond yields, by the fact that the UK had to pay more money to borrow money. And that means that the numbers don't add up anymore. So then we had the spring statement where Rachel Reeves rebalanced the books to get herself back to the exact same figure that she had in the autumn budget. And under a week later, Donald Trump introduces tariffs, sent government bond yields up again, and Rachel Reeves slipped straight back down the icy slope. Now, what's interesting is that since tariff day, we've had some quite big moves in the bond markets. And if you look at the US 10-year Treasury note, we're actually back now to roughly where we were in March. In fact, it's actually slightly lower at 4.2%. Not a perfect comparison, because what you're looking at also is that investors now think the Federal Reserve is going to have to cut rates by more than they thought before that. So that's influencing the direction there. But as a general sort of state of play, what has happened is that investors now want more money to lend money to the US, and that's going to cost the US money. That's what the problem is. And if you get stuck in a negative feedback loop, the Liz Truss moment, where bond yields just keep going up and up and up and up and up, people start to worry, people start to panic. And the more they see that there's a problem, the more they think there's a problem, and so on. And so you have to do something to arrest that spiral. And the other thing going on here, of course, was that Donald Trump expressed in quite vociferous terms his total lack of trust in the US Federal Reserve, its central bank, and his desire to have Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, removed from his position ASAP.
Yeah.
And somebody who was a bit more Trumpian running the show. People don't like that kind of thing, and that added to the concern. And ultimately, you know, the suggestion was that he had to step back from the brink because there were concerns that we were about to walk into another financial crisis. And the Liz Truss moment was bad for the UK, and it did rock global financial markets, but ultimately it wasn't a major issue for global financial markets because, you know, the UK is considerably smaller than the US. The US, were it to have a Liz Truss moment, would have the potential to trigger an actual full-scale financial crisis. And central bankers behind the scenes have been telling people that they were manning the pumps. Our city editor, Alex Brummer, was in Washington last week meeting with the great and the good of the financial world. I saw him yesterday. We were having a chat, and he said there was a number of conversations about there were moments over the past month or so where pumps were being manned and there were concerns that things could get really nasty.
Goodness me. And I imagine we're probably not out of the woods yet. Who knows? It's so unpredictable. Tanya, how does this affect us? As I said at the start, I mean, it affects everyone who pays tax, saves into a pension, invests for the future. What's the real world implication of what's going on around the world?
Well, people will remember during the Liz Truss crisis that people got very upset because it did have real world effects, particularly on mortgage rates. And I think going back to Trump for a moment, that was probably one of the things that made him pull back, because it was the really long dated bonds that there was a lot of problem with, that the yield was going up on, which would have affected a lot of people with mortgages in the US as well. In terms of investors here, a lot of people have got exposure to bonds without knowing, because they're used very heavily by pension schemes. Even if you have got years to go before you get your pension, you're probably in stocks at the moment. But as you get closer to retirement, sometimes automatically something will be triggered that's called lifestyling. And you'll probably be asked about it, but you might not understand what on earth they're talking about and just let it all run automatically, because a lot of people just let their pensions sit in the default fund and assume that they can carry on doing that right up to retirement. I would suggest that anybody who's within 10 years of retirement pay very close attention to any communications they get from their pension scheme, particularly about lifestyling, and try to make a decision about what they want to do, because you will be moved to some extent probably into bonds. And that's all very well when things are calm. But as you can see, things are really volatile with bonds at the moment. So you need to be clear about what you're doing. When there's a bond sell-off of the kind that Simon was describing, which has happened several times, your bonds become worth a lot less. Your pension funds can go down. We saw some people's pension funds go down dramatically. People were writing panicked emails to Steve Webb, our pensions columnist, saying, my pension fund's gone down £100,000 and I'm planning to retire in a few months' time. You can see how it would be particularly acute for somebody who was right on the verge of retiring, because people's real life plans continue while all this chaos in financial markets go on, and you don't want to be reaching pension age right in the middle of that. So people who invest in bonds, who have, say, got a bond fund as part of a portfolio, they are probably quite up on all this. They probably have a good general grasp of the kind of things that Simon was explaining to us earlier already. But I think the concern is the average pension saver who's in a work pension, who doesn't pay close attention and does not understand what lifestyling is and what it might mean to them in the run-up to retirement. If you're in that situation, we've just updated our guide on this, so I suggest you read that. And I definitely think it's worth even potentially ringing up your scheme and asking where you are in the lifestyling process and try to think whether you want to do this. It's worth saying that lifestyling is not a bad thing. Pension schemes do it with the best of intentions. They are trying to make sure that at the point you retire, you've not gone through a period of volatility and you're not in a really bad position. And bonds are considered a safe haven, as we've discussed. But you don't want to be caught out in a period of massive chaos like the ones we've seen recently. So you do need to work out how this affects your own personal situation, because it is important.
Tanya, thank you very much. We're going to stick with pensions, because a deal to buy voluntary state pension top-ups going back to 2006-2007 has now ended. But it seems the lost payment saga continues. This Is Money has covered numerous cases of lost state pension top-up payments, including one lasting 3 years. And readers struggles to persuade government staff to help find their money. Now, Tanya, you've been speaking to some of those affected. Firstly, remind us about the top-up saga and where we're at with it.
Well, people like buying state pension top-ups because they're a good deal. They can improve your state pension. You obviously need to live long enough to see the benefit, but you tend to do that within about 3.5 years after state pension age. And the government had a particularly good deal for quite a long time where it would allow you to buy the state pension top-ups going right back to 2006. There was a deadline to do that on the 5th of April, and now you can only go back and buy the last 6 years' worth. So as you can imagine, there was a big rush. There's historically always been a bit of an issue with top-ups, though, because the system is run between the DWP and HMRC. They both are responsible for different bits of it. Things can go wrong. Money can get lost between the two of them. It's suddenly, from the outside anyway, for the normal layperson looking in, they just think their money has gone missing. They will have proof in terms of the transfer that they made or the payment they made that they did actually give money to the government, which is something, but they don't get a receipt. And it can be extremely worrying, especially if time has gone on and you have not seen the benefit of it. Your national insurance record has not changed to reflect your payment, and your state pension forecast hasn't been revised. And if you're over state pension age, your payments haven't changed. And for the story that we wrote this week, we had a couple of cases where people had bought state pension top-ups quite a long time ago, and then they turned 66. And you can see why that would trigger great concern, because one person had bought their top-ups last May, and then they became 66 in late December, and they weren't seeing any benefit of it. And people who have handed over thousands of pounds to the government want to know what on earth is happening, understandably. We've written so many stories about this, that people who put state pension top-ups gone missing into a search engine almost immediately find our stories and write to us about it. So we do get quite a lot of, just not just our own readers, but people who have found our stories and then write in to us to tell us what's happened. So we've sorted out these latest cases, and a case of another one, a chap who was 59, he'd handed over £9,000. So even though he was under state pension age, he was obviously really concerned because it was such a large sum of money. He wanted to make sure that it had actually been processed. Also completely understandable. We're now in a situation where the deadline has just passed. I think people are well aware that there was a big rush and they're not necessarily going to get impatient just yet about what's happened to their money. They assume there's a backlog. They assume that they're in a queue. And we'll just have to see how well the government handles this backlog. They did tell us they put extra staff on it. There is now an online service where some of it anyway is automated, but anyone who needs it worked out manually will have to be relying on government staff to work through the backlog. So we'll have to see. We are starting to get emails with people getting a bit concerned, but I don't think the full impact of the big rush will be felt just yet. We will just have to see whether the resources the government put in place are going to be enough to deal with it efficiently.
Did you say they don't even get a receipt?
No, they don't send out receipts. If you do it online now, then obviously you get, I don't know if you get email confirmation, but presumably you get some kind of landing page to say that your payment has been processed. And obviously, if you have paid out of your bank account or you've paid by check, you have got proof. And we are talking about the government here. They will accept the proof from your bank statement if necessary.
Still, it just seems like such an easy thing to do. Anyway, what have DWP said in the latest?
In the latest, they've apologised for the delays to the readers' cases, and they have reassured people. If you're over state pension age, arrears will be paid back to the date of your payment. So obviously that's something else they need to work out and do the sums on. But yes, they're trying to reassure people that they will get all the money that they are owed once it's been sorted out.
Just a quick one on if anyone is thinking of buying top-ups. What do you need to consider? What should they be thinking about?
Well, life expectancy is a big one, obviously. If you're in good health, though, it's probably going to be a good deal. I think you do need to consider whether you're going to be on benefits. If you're going to, you know, you're not very well off, you think you might need to claim pension credit. Pension credit gives access to an awful lot of other things in terms of winter fuel payments, all sorts of other things. And it may well be buying top-ups to get a full state pension loses you access to a lot of things that if you're not very well off, you might really need. Those are a couple of the things. We've got a guide to top-ups, which is linked to in the current story, which is at the top of the pension homepage at the moment. I would suggest you read those guides because Steve Webb has helpfully provided a list of things to consider. And I think you should work through that, work out if any apply to you or whether you're one of the people who it's going to be a good deal for. It does involve some consideration, but for most people, it's a good deal.
Right. I've got one more story I want to talk about when it comes to pensions, because we hear all the time that, you know, as much as it's going up, the state pension is not enough to live on. And yet, I was reading a story this week that nearly 9 million people in the UK are heading into retirement with less than £6,750 a year in income from a private pension. Now, this is according to pension provider Now Pensions and the think tank, the Pensions Policy Institute, that found that the self-employed particularly were not saving enough. They had half that of the UK average. So you've got a guide on your website about how to find the right SIP or self-invested personal pension for you. So I think it'd be quite nice now just to take a look at that, if that's all right. Firstly, what are SIPs?
A SIP is a self-invested personal pension. It's an investment account that has a pension wrapper around your standard investment account. And what it does is it enables you to invest for your retirement by buying shares, funds, investment trusts, ETFs, bonds. You get the pension wrap around it, and that means you're doing it in a tax-friendly way. So when you pay money in, you will automatically get a basic rate uplift of 25% to the money that you pay in, and that's to replace the basic rate tax that you paid at 20%. So if you earn £100 and you get taxed £20 on it, then you will have £80 left. If you pay that £80 into your pension, you will get a 25% uplift on it, which is £20, that takes you back to the £100. So it takes you back to the position you were in before basic rate tax. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, of which there are increasingly large numbers, then you can reclaim the rest of the tax as well that you would have paid on that contribution. So there's a great boost to the money that you pay into a SIPP. Your investments can grow in there free of capital gains tax and dividend tax. At the end of it, when you withdraw money, the first 25% that you take out can be tax-free. That could be done as a lump sum. It could be done as individual amounts that you take out. And the rest of it is taxed at income tax. Money that you pay into a SIPP, you're not allowed to access currently until the age of 55, but that age is going up to 57 very soon. So most people listening to this and investing into a pension, it will be 57 and it might continue to go up after that. So the great advantage of investing in a pension is that you can't get the money. The great disadvantage of investing in a pension is that you can't get the money until you're 57. And a SIPP is effectively a really easy way for people to invest for retirement. And these actually first emerged when Gordon Brown was Chancellor. And there was actually a plan at one point to enable people to put buy-to-let properties into them. That was torpedoed just before it came in. But just when I started out, this is money. This was one of the big financial issues du jour. I mean, imagine that. Like the tax pain that you get now on buying a buy-to-let, the massive stamp duty that you pay, the way that the tax relief on mortgage interest has been changed so that you're actually paying tax on revenue rather than profit and all those other things we've done. And not so long ago, we were actually thinking about landlords being able to just easily stuff their property into a pension. Anyway, you can't do that. Right? Most people just use a SIPP in a really simple way. You can use them in quite complicated ways. Most people just use them in a really simple way as a way to buy investments, you know, funds, investment trusts, ETFs, individual shares, and invest in them with the aim that that pot is one that they are growing for retirement. And the first port of call to invest for your retirement should be your workplace pension if you're an employee. And that's because your employer has to match your contributions up to a certain level due to something called auto-enrollment. And actually, many employers will go better than that. And they will offer you a better deal than they would do under auto-enrollment. So the first place to invest for a pension is your workplace, if you are employed, because otherwise you're giving up that money that your employer would give you. If you're self-employed, then it's on you, right? So you've got to do it. So a SIPP is a great place to be doing it. But also lots of people like to invest for retirement outside of their work pension as well. They like to have another pension, which maybe has a bit more investment choice, or they're putting some extra money in for retirement. They don't want to do that through the workplace scheme. You know, consider doing it through a workplace scheme because it might be cheaper. But lots of people like to have a SIPP as well. And there are different platforms that offer them. Some of them are very big names that people recognize. So in our guide, we've got Hargreaves Lansdown. We've got AJ Bell. We've got Charles Stanley, the sponsors of this podcast. We've got other lesser known names that are more sort of newcomers to the market who can offer very cheap ways of doing it. For example, a company called InvestEngine that only offers ETFs. Another company called Prosper, which is an investing app. Now that's got a really interesting proposition because not only does it have no account fees and no dealing fees, it's also got 30 ETFs that it refunds the fees on the ETFs themselves to you. So you could, in theory, invest your pension at zero cost to yourself. And when it comes to choosing a SIPP, you need to remember, though, that cheapest isn't always best. What's best is what's right for you. Some people might need a bit more handholding. Some people might want the full range of investments all around the world they can choose from. Some might be happy with a much smaller selection and a bit more of a helping hand along the way or some lower fees. Now, what I'd recommend doing is going to thisismoney.co.uk/SIPPs, where you can find our guide, comprehensive guide, written by our new money and consumer guides writer, Sam Bromley. He's done a really great job on this. Have a look at it, and then don't just look at the numbers. Don't just look at the fees. Look at the bit below it where it talks about what makes a SIPP good and what makes a SIPP good for you, because what might be a good SIPP for me might not be a good SIPP for you, Georgie, or might not be a good SIPP for you, Tanya, because I might want to do, you know, other things than you might do. And I might put a higher price on the ability to invest in lots of different stuff. And you might put a higher price on something that's giving you a really good helping hand and Tanya might put a higher price on just having the fees to be as low as possible.
Any other pearls of wisdom, Tanya?
I think I'd just like to reiterate what Simon said about your starting point being your work pension. I've updated our guide to work pensions. You need to think of them with a different mindset. Don't attach them to your employer and your feelings about your employer. They are a cheap, subsidised investing product, which is already handed to you. It is given to you. You don't have to open it. You don't have to do anything. It exists already. Now, it may well be that there's not very many investment options in there. You might not want very many, but the fees are likely to be cheap, especially on the default fund. They're capped at 0.75%. And the big pension schemes have lots of buying power to get fees down. So they are likely to be cheaper. If, for all the reasons that Simon's discussed, you want to open a SIPP, then absolutely fine. But make sure you've definitely maxed out all your matching contributions before you start putting money elsewhere, because you're getting free money for your employer that way. I just think make full use of your work pension. Think of it as an investment account, a free subsidised investment account, not something that is some nightmare thing that your employer puts on you as some burden or anything like that. It is actually a great opportunity to invest easily and cheaply.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, a question here from a listener. My mum has offered to pay £300 a month into a lifetime ISA for me to help build up a house deposit. Can she pay it in directly, or does she have to give me the money first?
Okay, so the mum would need to give the son or daughter the money first. This is because, like all ISAs, contributions must come from a bank account in their name. So lifetime ISA rules mean you must be between 18 and 39 to open a lifetime ISA. You can contribute up to £4,000 per year until you turn 50, and the government adds a 25% bonus to any contributions, meaning if you save a maximum of £4,000, you get an additional £1,000. Those savings can be used for either a first home costing up to $450,000 or for retirement. For parents wanting to help the children buy a home, giving them cash to put into a lifetime ISA is a great way to do it. However, they need to consider the effects from an inheritance tax perspective, as £300 per month would exceed the annual gift exemption.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Sorting out how to pay for long-term care is one of the trickiest and most emotional, I would imagine, money decisions that a family can face. Now, the Labour government abandoned plans for an £86,000 lifetime care spending cap, and plans for a national care service are still years away. So in the meantime, some families are turning to something called care annuities to guarantee care fees are covered. Tanya, what is the current situation with funding care in this country?
So the current situation is that people are expected to self-fund care fees down to a floor of £23,250, at which point state help will start to kick in. Not fully, there's a sliding scale. That is the floor, and it includes your house if you're going to residential care. But if you're getting care in your own home, your local authority might vary the £23,250, but it won't go below that. And then in that situation, your house is not included in the financial assessment for care fees. As you can see, people are expected to pay for their own care to a greater extent. That can be controversial, but you have to look at it in two ways. Yes, people are expected to spend an awful lot of money on their own care. And if you are incredibly unlucky and need a lot of care for many years, it will eat up all of your assets, potentially down to that level. On the other hand, taxpayers probably will not be happy about the idea of funding all the care fees for somebody who owns £1 million house and has got a vast amount of assets, and providing full care services for decades for someone in that scenario. If you put that proposition to voters, they wouldn't be happy about that either. I think the difficulty lies in the potentially catastrophic nature of the fees if you if you personally or a family member are unlucky enough to, say, get dementia and need care for a really long time, because we have the NHS in this country which looks after everyone. And I think that we expect some level of social insurance for care as well, so that you're not completely, your finances aren't completely wrecked just because you're unlucky enough to have a certain health condition over another. Just for the sake of argument, have a family member go with a heart attack as opposed to get dementia, and whether that will ruin the family's financial planning and inheritance and so on. So there have been various schemes suggested over the years, which will no doubt be looked at again by this independent commission, where there's some kind of level of social insurance. The last proposal with a spending cap maybe had some elements of that, arguably not enough, but where we'll share the burden as a society financially of people's care when they're elderly. And it's a moral situation as well as a financial one. We want to make sure that people who are badly off or well off get decent care when they need it. We may all end up in that situation one day. Anyone with any empathy whatsoever could imagine themselves or a close relative being in that situation, and you would understandably want them to have the best care possible and be prepared to pay for it. You only need to think about your own parents. Anybody with a heart would want them to be looked after properly. All this comes back to care annuities. This is a form of insurance, and this is you doing it yourself, basically. When it comes to paying for care, people might just pay it out of their savings, especially if they might not have long to live. They go into a care home and their health is in a rather desperate state already. Or you can set up investments that you can draw down from, similar to the way people fund retirement, although you may want to, in that case, invest in things that are considered more safe or at any rate less volatile, so that you know that the income is coming through. But care annuities are another option. There's only a handful of providers, but it involves obviously paying a lot of money up front. You do have to go through a financial advisor. My understanding from when investigating this story is that the providers of annuities, because it's quite a complicated decision, they want people to have a financial advisor to talk them through all their options so that they know for absolute certain that they want to buy an annuity. You can get capital protection in case somebody died immediately after you paid hundreds of thousands of pounds potentially for your care fees to be covered for the rest of your life. But it is still a big outlay. It would give peace of mind that the care fees are going to be taken over. And there are a couple of special features about care annuities, also known as immediate needs annuities, I ought to say, just in case you hear them talked about in that jargon instead. The income from them is paid direct to the care provider, which might be an at-home provider or a residential care home. And it is paid income tax free. Now, that is a massive tax benefit, obviously. And it's definitely something to seriously consider, because you could save a lot of tax doing that way. Also, obviously, it takes the admin off your hands if the annuity provider is just paying your care provider direct for your elderly parent. I'm sure people have got enough to deal with already in that kind of scenario, without worrying about that too. So it's a tricky decision, but I think care annuities are a good option. I don't think they're very well known about, and I definitely think this income tax break is not widely known about. So I think it's worth thinking about.
So just to be clear, that it's paid at the kind of point that you would need care, presumably it would probably be paid by your family, is that right? So it's not like a pension annuity when you'd buy it in advance of that. So it's sort of a given that you're needing to go into care. Is that right?
Yes, I think they're really suitable for someone who definitely needs care. It's not a long-term funding for everyday expenses.
Just in case I go into care kind of thing. Right.
No, it's not. I don't think it's a just in case scenario. I think it's if somebody actually is needing care. And I think the financial advisor, which you would need to get, would potentially sort of steer you away from them if they thought you only might need care at some later point.
Simon, you were shaking your head at parts of what Tanya was saying, not because she was wrong, of course, but because you were a bit, I suppose, I don't know, disillusioned with the whole system. Something needs to get done, doesn't it? Because this is, I don't know if it's a kicking can down the road sort of thing, but can't some government grasp this by the metal and do something with it?
I think the whole thing is a shambles, and it's an embarrassing shambles. I think that this is an absolutely prime example of something that I have bemoaned on this podcast, where we make policy by trying to fit numbers into a spreadsheet rather than what we think is right for the country. So we know that we need to do something about care costs. We know that we need to do something about the current system. We know that it doesn't work. And instead of doing something about the current system, we've repeatedly kicked the can down the road. Why have we kicked the can down the road? Because we don't have the money. We don't have the money to fit it into the spreadsheets that get knocked up when we do an autumn budget or a spring statement or a spring budget or an autumn statement. And this is not a crack at Rachel Reeves. The most recent part of this will be a crack at Rachel Reeves, but it's a crack at all the people who have come before her, with actually the honourable exception of one man who doesn't always get a lot of credit for his leadership of the country. But there was one person who was actually going to do something about this and very committed to it, Boris Johnson, who said, this is not right. We need to sort this out. And the reason why we need to sort this out is because the coalition government commissioned a report in 2010 called the Dilnot Review, where Andrew Dilnot looked into this, said, this is totally broken, and came up with a suggestion which involved basically putting a cap on the amount that people paid in care costs out of their own money, and then beyond that, the state would fund it. This was what he considered to be the fairest thing. And it was widely considered to be a pretty good way of dealing with the problem, and nobody dealt with the problem at all. Eventually, Boris Johnson did get elected and say, I'm going to do something about it. He laid out the plans in September 2021. They were due to kick in October 2023. And what that was going to do was introduce a new £86,000 cap on the amount anyone in England will need to spend on their personal care over their lifetime. And that would mean that once you'd spent £86,000 on care, that was it, and the state would step in and they would pick up the tab, okay? And also, the point at which people became eligible to receive some financial support from their local authority would rise to £100,000 from the current £23,250. That £23,250 is ludicrously low. To say, oh, well, once you've got more than that, you're rich and you should be paying for care, is completely stupid. And like the figure also, as a classic thing, needs to have been moving up with inflation and care home fees and all those other things. And if you look at care costs are astronomical. So the average cost of care in the UK is £1,387 per week. And actually, that, you know, varies regionally. And when we write articles about this, we get a lot of comments from people saying, yeah, and the rest, as in they're paying much more than that. That's £72,000 a year. It has such an unbelievable amount of money. It has the ability to totally burn through people's assets and lifetime savings. Now, there is a question about whether people should be picking up some of the tab for this themselves, and if they are wealthy, how much they should be. So, for example, you know, there'll be people out there who've got final salary pensions that pay them that much. Should that person, who if they're in a care home, they're not going to need their final salary pension to be living on, should that person have their tab picked up? But instead of actually dealing with any of that stuff, we just keep kicking the can down the road. And instead of like bringing in the Tory plan to deal with this, which was not a bad plan, okay? It was a pretty decent plan, and it certainly would have made it a lot fairer. That got scrapped by the current government. And to be fair to the current government, the Tories had already kicked that can down the road after Boris lost power and Rishi came into power. My concern is that we're not going to do anything about this. We've got another independent commission, and then it's going to come up with some findings, and then we're going to have a think about it, and then we're going to do something, and it's just nothing's going to happen about it. And in the meantime, you know, there's a lottery going on as to whether you're the unfortunate person who ends up in care or the unfortunate person whose family member ends up in care. And the current system is really not very fair. One of the issues with the suggestion of the £86,000 cap was, for example, that actually it favoured those with more assets, because say you've only got £100,000 right, then you'd get 86 grand of that wiped out and you're left with a lower proportion of your total assets. Whereas if you've got £1 million, you still only get 86 grand of that wiped out and you're left with a greater percentage. Maybe we need to bring in something where it's a percentage of your overall assets or something like that. But what I do know is that it is absolutely shameful that we have not done anything about this. And actually, in reality, it's not that many people who end up in care for a really long time. So as a society, perhaps, you know, considering all of the tax we take in from people and everything like that, we should be picking up the tab for it, is my personal view. Other people disagree. But I think that regardless of what your personal view is, the fact that we haven't sorted this problem out in 15 years is a national embarrassment.
I hear what you say about Boris Johnson, Simon, but I think an honourable mention needs to go to Theresa May as well, who did come up with a plan to deal with this. Unfortunately, it was very, very unpopular, but at least she had a go. The other thing is, I think, to be fair to the current government, when you say the Conservatives let it go somewhat after Boris left office, Labour said that it was unfunded in the current plans, which I guess means that the Tories hadn't put any money aside to deal with something that was going to come in say, a year's time, and that they were then going to have to find the money from scratch. And they obviously have their own plan for a national care service, and I suppose that they wanted to start again. Maybe they will come up with something cross-party. It would definitely be good. I think it's a worthy effort to try and come up with something that everybody buys into and that isn't going to be changed with every change of government, if they can agree. But the devil's in the detail, isn't it? It's like deciding at what point we're going to start paying people's full care fees. You know, how rich you need to be before we as a society are willing to say, oh yeah, you can keep all of that and give it all to your family when you die, and we're going to take full care of you. Beside that, it's very, very difficult one to decide.
All right, we'll leave that to one side for now. And fearing that cash ISAs, sticking with the government theme, would be in line for the government chopping block, savers raced to stuff theirs. There's always something of a stampede to stash money into the tax-free accounts at the end of the tax year, but a whopping $4.2 billion was funneled into cash ISAs this March. Now that's up almost a third on the previous year. Simon, are we surprised? What's going to happen to cash ISAs?
Oh, well, I mean, what's going to happen to cash ISAs? It looks like there might be some changes coming. The government is not denying the changes coming. The government is making noises. It even dropped a little kind of teaser into the budget that it was looking at some stuff. There are people within the investment industry largely who are often have quite vested interests, who are very keen to push more people into investing and make it that you can have a lower cash ISA allowance than investment ISA allowance. They'd like people to get more money to put in a stocks and shares ISA and less into a cash ISA. Broadly speaking, I would say we should just leave the whole thing alone, to be perfectly honest. The ISA system actually used to work like that, and we stopped it working like that because it was considered to be a bad thing and not working properly. So we would be going backwards. Yes, there are some people putting large amounts of money into cash ISAs, and that means they're not paying tax on their savings. But they've probably paid tax on the money that they put into the savings in the first place anyway, right? So, and chances are they paid a lot of tax on the money that they put into the savings in the first place. Chances are they paid 40% tax. The people who are filling up their cash ISAs probably paid 40% tax somewhere along the way. And the reason why cash ISAs are so popular is because the personal savings allowance hasn't budged since it was introduced at £1,000 many moons ago, and is only £500 for higher rate taxpayers. And that hasn't budged either. And it's zero for 45p taxpayers. And there's a lot more 40% taxpayers and 45% taxpayers because the tax thresholds haven't budged either. So it's just people trying to do what they can about the fact that they're already being caught out by the system. So catching them out again would seem to me to be a slightly stupid move. And also, it's just going to create a massive backlash. It's going to be really unpopular. Don't do it. Rachel Reeves, if you're listening to this, don't do it. Don't make yourself any less popular with the population. I think that you actually could be a very good chancellor. And I think I'd like to see you stick it out, right? Don't make yourself any less popular with people. please. Like, just let's move on from this constant, you know, box ticking, spreadsheeting that we're talking about and actually do the right thing for once. Why are people sticking all this money into cash ISAs? Well, firstly, because they're worried that if they don't do it now, something might have happened to them. And some people were rushing to do it ahead of the spring statement because they actually thought there might be an announcement in that. And they're also, what they think is that basically if they stick the money in, any changes are unlikely to be retrospective. So money they get into a cash ISA is probably going to be safe. They're concerned about the stock market. So obviously that's pushing a bit more money into cash ISAs as well. And also cash ISA rates are absolutely banging. They are really, really good. Over the last kind of, you know, 3 to 6 months, cash ISAs have been storming ahead of the rest of the savings market. Easy access cash ISAs have had some stunning rates, even allowing for the 3 month bonus madness that seems to be fizzling out now. They're better rates than on standard savings accounts, which isn't usually the way. So if you haven't used your cash ISA allowance or you haven't used your ISA allowance and you've got some money to put into savings, put it into a cash ISA. Don't put it into a standard savings account. There's literally no benefit of using a standard savings account over a cash ISA at the moment. So that's why so much money has gone into them.
Just briefly, Tanya, I mean, if messing around with cash ISAs isn't the answer to get us all investing, you're a pensions and investing expert, investment expert, what will?
I agree with Simon that we should not be messing about with cash ISAs and we should keep the current limit, and I think Rachel Reeves would be absolutely mad to do anything like this, but I think it's down to personal choice. Obviously, I write about investing all the time, and I write about investing through pensions all the time, but ultimately it's people's personal decision, and we can encourage them and we can tell them, we give them the facts about how it might, they might be much better off over the long term. But if they don't accept that, or if they have some reason in their life why they want a lot of cash on hand, that should be up to them. All we can do is give people the facts, which we always do in all of our stories, and then leave people to make up their own mind. And that for me is at the heart of this whole debate about what we do with the cash ISA limit. People should be able to put their money in a cash ISA or investing ISA as they choose.
All right then, Tanya, thank you very much. Simon, your stat of the week.
Okay, my stat of the week is 1 month ago, Donald Trump stood up and announced his tariffs. Generally, it's been seen as not a great month for investors, except if you actually look at the FTSE 100 and the top risers on the FTSE 100, there's some companies that have done astonishingly well over the last month. And the biggest riser over 1 month is B&M, the value store chain, whose shares are up 19.9%, followed by Berkeley Holdings, whose shares are up 19%. We've got 3i, which is a sort of private equity investment group, up 16%. EasyJet up 15%. Entain, the gambling firm, up 14.7%. Persimmon, the house builder, 14.6%. Taylor Wimpey, the house builder, 13.9%. The list goes on. In fact, actually, when you look at this, out of the top 20 risers on the FTSE, they have all risen by more than 9.2% over the past month. That's not a bad return for a month's worth of investing if you held any of those shares.
So is that your stats, Simon? Because I got a lot of stats there. So are we going to pick one?
There's multiple stats. Yeah, the biggest riser on the FTSE 100 over the past month is B&M, which is up 19.9%. And the biggest faller, if you'd like to know that too, is Bunzl, which is down 23%.
Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you very much, Tanya. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast paths and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.